today we are very happy to have Dr. To Be, right?
That's the plan.
Okay, Dr. To Be, Robert Lazenby from Oxford, and it's going to be a very rich talk because he had a very rich lunch. So bombarding his question early on when his blood sugar is still very low. He'll tell us about nuclear dark matter.
Okay, so thank you very much for the introduction and the nice hockey stick here. Okay, so I'm going to talk, like it says, about nuclear dark matter, both building it up in the early universe and some of the kind of late time phenomenology that you might see. So, well, to start off with, what actually we're talking about. And the general idea is, okay, so taking inspiration from the case of standard model nuclei, so in that case, we have the protons, neutrons, fundamental particles, but most of what we see in the universe today is in the form of nuclei, so large composite bound states with some conserved number, which means we have some spectrum of them that can get built up. So roughly, what are the possibilities if a similar kind of thing happens in the dark sector? And there are some, well, you can imagine some very interesting kind of phenomenology that you might get. So again, you could get some kind of distribution over some number of dark matter states. You could get large states which have large spatial structure, large spin, because of their large spatial structure and large number of constituents. You could have coherent enhancement interactions. You have the potential for building up very large objects, depending on the formation process. And well, I'll talk through some of these possibilities in more detail in this talk. So an early example of this sort of thing, not quite exactly the kind of thing we're talking about, was cue balls, so non-topological solitons of scalar fields, dark matter candidate there. And related work quite recently, so Gordon and Chris here, William Detmold and McCulloch et al. From MIT, and also some slightly kind of different models from other people. Okay, so going on to sort of still the inspiration thing. So with standard model nuclei, you have the binding energy, so you have that the binding energy is set by the volume energy, which is roughly constant. You have some kind of surface energy, which is just set by the surface tension, which would together give you a nicely rising thing, so the binding energy per nucleon. But you have a Coulomb force, which is repulsive, which means that your curve turns over after iron up here, and then nuclei larger than that are less strongly bound per nucleon and disfavored. If you just turned off Coulomb repulsion, you get something going up like that. And so you'd have the possibility of building up very large nuclei. That's sort of rough inspiration. Okay, so the kind of early universe synthesis process that you'd be looking at would be something along the lines of standard model VBN. So at early times, at very large temperatures, you'd have everything dissociated. So there, the entropy term and the free energy dominates, and even if larger states are more strongly bound, you still favor everything being, yeah?
Why won't it just continue? You can have a huge curve, why can't it just continue?
Oh, it did, yeah, no, absolutely. So this was only showing up some number. You continue going, and the whole point of what I'm gonna be talking about is that, yes, when you're talking about the regime where you're cut off by the formation process rather than cut off, like in the standard model, by the small number behavior or anything like that. So yeah, you could build up as large as you're able to actually build up if you just carried on going. Okay, and so yeah, so at small temperatures, everything in single constituents, so large temperatures even, small temperatures, the favored state would be for everything, would be for things to be in very large states. Because of the binding energy, that's the more strongly bound. And then you'd have some intermediate stage where you try to build these things up. So we're going to assume we're in the regime of asymmetric dark matter here. Otherwise, most of the process is just things hitting and annihilating. You're not going to get interesting build. Well, you might be able to get interesting types of build-up processes going on there, but that'd be a rather different kind of model. Okay, so to answer that kind of question, if you don't have any other barriers, to this. How far could you build up if all that was stopping you was the rate at which things were hitting each other and able to fuse together? Okay, so if the dominant kind of process at each stage is equal size collisions, so you at each stage have a population of things that are roughly the same size, and most fusions are one thing, one of those hitting another thing and forming something kind of roughly twice as big, then the rate of these kind of things for a single one per Hubble time, just set by cross-section times number density. So if we assume that we get to a regime where the cross-sections reach a geometric kind of limit, so we're assuming that these things are roughly uniform matter, so as you build up with A constituents here, you'd get the radius going as A to the third, area going as A to the two-thirds, et cetera. So geometric saturation would be going like A to the two-thirds. If we're assuming they're in thermal equilibrium, then the velocity would go down as A to the minus a half, and the number density, if we got them all at about the same kind of size, would go as 1 over A. So putting all this together, we'd get this going down as A to the minus 5/6 times whatever the appropriate quantity was for basically, yeah.
Sorry, can I ask about the A to the two-thirds factor? Yeah. I understand that the total interaction, it makes sense to me that the total interaction
yes.
cross-section would go like A to the two-thirds.
Sure.
But it's much less clear that the binding into the larger object cross-section would go like A to the two-thirds.
Exactly, so yeah, that's certainly true. This is as large as it could be.
Okay.
So in any specific model, of course, you might have that, say, most of those things
okay.
result
so
in...
trying to get an upper bound.
Exactly, yeah. You might have a lot of these things being fragmentation type events or something like that. But yeah, this is as large as it can be in a specific model. You'd have some kind of lower than this. But it still might go geometrically, so you get roughly this scaling. Okay, so, well, so putting in some numbers for this kind of factor, if you put in roughly kind of standard model-ish values for constituents, which we'll come back to you later just to find this kind of thing, then the rate of those per Hubble time turns out that that's actually really pretty high. So if you plug in the A to the 5/6, so then you get this number to the 6/5, you could, if this was, you get an upper bound of about higher than 10 to the 8. So you really could build up very large things from this. Of course, you'd need to see whether you actually manage that. So that was if things were equal sizes, so an A and an A going to a 2A or something approximately like that. In a different regime where most of your buildup is by smaller things hitting larger things, so in the extreme case, it would be a sort of a single one hitting an A going to a 1 plus A, the rate for A of these things to happen to a single A-size nucleus, so for it to double in size, is just this with 1 over A there. And this is very much like this, except that for the velocity suppression, we get a 1 over k to the half instead. So instead of a to the minus 5/6, we get an a to the minus 1/3 there. So if we're assuming that we're in thermal equilibrium throughout this process, the fact that the smaller things are moving much faster than the larger things means that in this approximation, this one could actually freeze out quite a lot later. Again, so the k is... Oh, sorry, this is a 1. So the k here is the size of the small things.
Oh,
so this would just be a 1 here.
All right.
Yeah, sure. So again, you'd need to see whether this actually works. But in that case, they could freeze out even later. So you could build up to extremely large values here. So that'd be something silly like 10 to 16 or so. OK, so those are the kind of limits that you could get to. Now we'll look at what actual sort of synthesis processes might actually be able to do. Still in a fairly general case. OK. Well, so the first question, we started out with everything being dissociated, and then these dissociations become less important as we go to lower temperatures. And so the important point there is that generically you might expect that they stop being important fairly quickly relative to your Hubble time. So you've got some overall forward rate for a process set by your fusion type events minus your dissociation type events, and then by sort of usual detail balance considerations, the fusions are going to dominate over dissociations if this factor, where you've got an exponential of the binding energy difference over the temperature, is much larger than some constant. Because we're assuming our things are dilute, so these things are reasonably heavy, this factor is much smaller than 1. So you get equality here at temperatures much less than the binding energy. this is the usual recombination style argument. So you go from equality here to this thing being much, much bigger than one within some small fraction of a Hubble time. And as we'll see later, most of the synthesis kind of process would happen within a Hubble time, so a difference of a small fraction probably wouldn't make much difference. Okay, so come back to that point later. Right, so if we're going to ignore dissociation, so we'll come to the point where the fusion processes are dominating, then we'd have the usual kind of Boltzmann equation set up. So the rate of change of the number density for a particular size k would be set by, so Hubble expansion, the rate of k's fusing with other things into larger things, and the rate of k's being fused from smaller things. At this point, yeah, we're again neglecting collisions that say involve fragmentation type processes, those kind of things. That would be, yes, additional complications. We're just going to look at this simple fusions only case to start with. So we can separate out the bits of this equation. So we've got bit, yeah.
What is the energy loss mechanism that creates bound states? Because you do need an energy loss mechanism to create bound states.
So in general, you're going to need either some kind of extra lighter state. So if you assume that in standard model, you could say pions were a bit lighter, then you could de-excite into those in nuclear processes. Alternatively, what standard model nuclei actually do are generally send off single nucleons. So if you had some, yeah, you have some large one hitting another large nucleus, you're going to send off one or two single nucleons, carrying away most of the binding energy. So that kind of thing wouldn't actually make much of a difference to the scaling type, the large collisions. Yeah. So in the large case, that wouldn't make much of a difference. In the small plus large case, it would. There, you would need some kind of additional lighter state to de-excite into. Okay, so this Boltzmann equation, it's putting together the rate of expansion. These are going to depend on the velocity and the number densities. So we can separate all these things out a bit by non-dimensionalizing our quantities. So we can separate out the expansion by putting our number densities into dimensionless yields. So these are our little yk, where we're normalizing the total yield as well. So these are just going to sum to one. We can define a new time variable, w, which is going to take into account our dependence on the overall cross-section and velocity, and then get to an equation for the dimensionless yields in terms of this new time variable, where we just have this in terms of some kernel, which parameterizes the fusion, so the rate of fusions from kj to k plus j in this kind of situation. And this one will be independent of the time and expansion rate and all these things, so separating out the variables. Okay, and then, well, we can go and solve that numerically. So again, so if we're looking at the case where we've gone to this large regime where we're going to take geometrical approximations to cross sections, so like add up the radius squared times relative velocity, then what you get, this is solving numerically, so this is at some time, this is at equally spaced log W values, so early times and then progressively later times, you get this nice kind of curve that if you look at it on a log scale, doesn't really change its shape, just sort of gets translated down to the right as you go up in time. And what that's a sign of is that you're hitting an attractor solution of a form. So if you plot all these things out with respect to not size but average size, then each of these different colors, so the blue, the green, the yellowy thing, they all just overlay extremely nicely on each other. So these are different numerical solutions plotted with respect to average size. And,
Robert?
Yes?
Sorry, I'm asking this because I'm actually late coming in probably.
No, thanks.
I said this before. So are you assuming you have protons and neutrons, or do you have one type of nucleon?
So we're assuming that we can just take a single size parameter A here that matters. So there's only it's only the overall size that matters here.
So let's say that's just neutrons.
Yes. you could certainly look at the kind of case where you, I mean, the reason why, well, protons are especially important in the Stannard model because you have Coulomb.
Yes,
you also
exactly.
have.
But here you don't.
We're assuming you don't have that kind of thing. Of course, you also have pairing effects and all kinds of other nonsense. We're not going to look at that at the moment.
Are you assuming the interaction? Yeah, so it's still, yeah, so it's a compiling, so effectively it's still short-range interactions like
yeah.
it is in the.
So the kind of model you're thinking of is one where you've got basically sort of uniformish matter that's building up these states. So
yes.
something like a short confining interaction, which has some short-range repulsion and short-range attraction as well.
Yeah, basically you have next neighbors.
Yeah, interaction. Something like that would result in these kind of scenarios. Okay, so yeah, so the point is that and mathematically, for these kind of kernels, it can actually be proved, and this is a sort of reasonable chunk of maths literature, that you eventually reach an attractor solution depending only on the large K form of this kernel. So in the previous slide, if you scale up the sizes of your individual things, then your rates go like the size to the power 1/6 as you go up, taking into account the area and the velocity.
But I'm moving back a little bit to the symbols.
Okay.
Could you say again, what is K?
So K was so it parameterizes the fusion rates in this non-dimensionalized equation. So you start with your actual cross-sections, your sigma Vs. You non-dimensionalize your variables to take out the dependence on the time and scale factor, all these things.
Some sort of a cross-section.
Exactly, yeah. So
that's a big thing, right?
Yeah. So that's...
Little
k is the number that you're up to. Big K is your cross-section in your non-dimensionalized variables.
Okay. And then your plot is a plot of...
So this plot is a plot of... So this is your size, little k,
right.
And this is your dimensionless constant. This is your dimensionless yield of nuclei at that value of k. Okay.
And the different solutions represent.
So these are different times. So we start out with everything very small, and then so this is the first time step. So we start out with everything at size 1.
Uh-huh.
In the first time step, it builds up this kind of distribution. The next time step, these will build up to slightly larger things, so it gets shifted down to the right, down because you're keeping the same overall concentration because we've non-dimensionalized that out, and to the right because we're building up larger sizes. Okay.
So basically, as time passes by,
yeah.
you move to the lower curve.
Yes.
Basically, you move as time goes by, you go this way.
Down to the right, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
And do you assume that the sector is in thermal equilibrium at some point
yes.
in the standard model?
Well, no, sorry. This is a kinetic equilibrium among
within the sector.
Among itself, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So there's some effective temperature in that sector.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
It doesn't have to be the same.
So we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Right. Yes, so the point was that, there's mathematical literature on this, and that the conclusion is that you get this kind of attractor solution. Which depends only on the large K behavior of our kernel, which here is the big K thing, which you reach independently of the initial conditions and what the small k kernel was. So here's an example where you reach it really quite quickly. So,
say that again.
So
big K is the cross, is the form factor?
So big K is the non-dimensionalized cross-section for fusion interactions. So Kij would be the non-dimensionalized cross-section for I plus J. Goes to I plus J.
Okay, and K is the size. Look at K is the size.
Yes. In retrospect, that was maybe a bad idea.
Yeah.
I'll take that. That was taken under consideration. Okay. So, yeah, so you reach this form independently of the initial conditions and of the small k kernel. And that's mathematically true for however much you mess with these things. And our example, of course, the question is whether you reach it quickly or not. In this example, we do reach it really quite quickly. So these curves all overlay extremely nicely onto what turns out to be the correct theoretical kind of form. So you reach this kind of scaling distribution, at which point, so further evolution in time just scales the whole thing to slightly larger sizes. According to this, so we get this 6/5 behavior. So this does actually realize the kind of upper bound parametrically you get from just considering the freeze out of fusions from earlier. Okay. So just to illustrate that you do have rough independence of initial conditions. So if we started off, if we gave it a bit of a head start, so instead of starting it off with a very steeply falling thing, we started off with a thing that's like gets up to 30 or so to start off with, then initially we would have reached this dark, this bold black curve. We reach a curve which basically corresponds to getting a little bit further along, and yeah, you reach the scaling solution with an extra little head start. So they're qualitatively exactly the same kind of thing. If alternatively you start out with most things small, but a few things at really high k, at really large sizes, then those don't matter, as you'd expect, from the fact the fusions are frozen out by the earlier kind of calculations, and you reach almost exactly the kind of distribution you got to before with this little extra bit that you tacked on. So yeah, so just demonstrating numerically that, yeah, it doesn't really make much difference if you change the initial conditions around quite a bit. Okay, so that was in the terms of this new time variable W, which took out all of the real-time behavior. If we put that back in, so if we had the temperature in this sector going as 1 over A, so like radiation dominated, and then you solve for what this W is as a function of temperature, you get that it goes, so the overall scale it gets to is set by this number that was we originally saw in the freeze-out calculations for the fusions. And it gets there basically mostly within one Hubble time and then asymptotes to that quite quickly. So if you look at, so this is plotting it out, the same kind of distribution, number, and then concentration at that number with respect this time at half e-folding time intervals. So this is half a Hubble time, then full Hubble time. So it gets to almost there quite quickly and then just asymptotes towards this kind of value. So the point is, and this is...
Sorry, but surely that should be, that statement should depend, the thing you have in red should depend on the ratio of the Hubble scale to the rate.
No, the point is that, so we start...
If I just have a very, very small cross section, why should it be fit within one Hubble time?
Because it'll be cut off after that. You won't build up to a lot, so the rate, this thing, sets the eventual size you get up to.
You won't get an asymptotic form, right?
Oh, yeah, no, okay, this is true. So as if you're... if the number is large enough to get to the asymptotic form, then once you're there, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. Sure. That's the statement. But yeah, just by the kinematics of the process, that most of the stuff happens within the first Hubble time, because after that, the expansion and the drop in temperature means that things are slower and just less stuff happens in the whole time after that than happens in the first Hubble time. Okay. So that's what things look like in real time. So you fairly quickly asymptote to the kind of eventual distribution. Right, okay, so that was the sort of large plus large case. So what if, and in that case, we did actually turn out that things kept on being sort of roughly the same size all the way through. So just going back to this kind of thing, you can see that most of the stuff is within, well, of order like a decade or so in size. You have very suppressed numbers at small k and very suppressed numbers at large k. Okay, so can we realize the kind of regime where the dominant thing is small plus large, where we worked out earlier that actually that could freeze out even later. You could have even larger sizes being built up. And, well, the sort of obvious way to do that is just to try and keep a population of small things around. And to do that, you can just reduce the the kernel for small number fusions. So we need to take the example of the standard model. So in standard model BBN, you have basically two kind of bottlenecks of this kind. The first one from deuterium. So deuterium is fairly weakly bound compared to the states that follow it. So it takes quite the cross-section, the net. The approximation that we're using of just fusions breaks down, but effectively, it takes quite a long time for your net forward motion through that, so fusions minus associations, to become large. So that Q keeps you quite a large population of hydrogen still, and you build up rather few beyond that. There's also the bottleneck once you get past helium-4. So helium-4 is very tightly bound compared to the things that come after it. And in standard model BBN, you basically don't make it past that bottleneck. You get very small fractions of things larger than that, but that stops you, that cuts you off. So here we're interested in the case where it doesn't cut you off entirely, but the fact that you have some reasonably large population of small things still hanging around has an effect on the overall process. So if we look at, yeah, again, this extreme example of 1 plus k goes to k plus 1 fusions, then if we take a given thing of size k and it's got one secreting onto it, then the rate of change of its size with our time variable is set by the kernel for 1 and k to go to k plus 1 times the concentration of 1s. And this kernel is proportional to the area of the state, so k to the 2/3. So that means that the eventual k that we can build up to goes, if this number is large throughout, like our time variable w to the power 3, as opposed to the 6/5 earlier. So again, the same kind of freeze-out calculation we did before. And if you actually simulate this, so here was our original scaling distribution, so the one that we got from before. If we crank this down by a factor of 10 to the 4 or so, then what we get is this curve. So we actually build up to, on average, larger numbers because the dominant process for building these things up is small plus large fusions. As we bring it down even further, we get out to average, on average, even larger things. Now, in this point, we're getting to the regime where some of the stuff at the end of the process still just remains at very small numbers. But in this one, most of the stuff has managed to build up to larger numbers than you would have originally. Yep.
Does it require tuning of the nuclear cross-section processes?
Well, we'll see on the next slide. So it requires that, you be in some intermediate regime. If you make this bottleneck too small, of course you never get through it. Like in the case of standard model BBN, you never get past the helium-4 bottleneck just because there are a load of states after that that have small binding energies relative to that. You effectively build up to there and stop. That could happen. If you're intermediate between scaling and the regime where you just stop it, then you get this kind of thing. Okay, so, the other question is...
So in this plot, how would the standard model look like? If you start in one of the first, like the curve has a lot of stuff in the first and then some stuff in the...
Well, the standard model would look like you never got through to either of the asymptotic regimes. Yeah, it would look like just a few things down here, and their abundances would be set by complicated properties of those states. So you never get into the asymptotic regimes in the standard model. But anyway, so in the previous case, the scaling regime had this asymptotic form which was reasonably independent of initial conditions. Do you get something similar in this case where you have small plus large? And the answer is yes, you can expect a kind of power law distribution. So the maximum k that you end up with is basically the time that it's got to accrete stuff to the power 3. And if you work that through, you should find that the concentration at k should go like k to the minus 2/3. So like 1 over the area. And if you plot the kind of results you get out, so you see that, so here's our original scaling distribution. As we reduce the 1 plus 1 cross-section, so we start off just by making a slight difference at small k, but it quickly converges back. As you reduce it further, it makes a bigger difference, still eventually converges. Reduce it far enough, it doesn't eventually converge. You get to a power law kind of behavior and more things at even larger k. So to summarize, what you get, if you assume that these states obey geometrical kind of scaling laws once they're large enough, then you have two possible universal regimes that you might get to. Emphasis on might. This is only if they make it through the small number stages, which they might well not, as in the case of the standard model. But you have two reasonably universal large number regimes. The first, this scaling distribution, where you have the dominant process being large plus large, and then also the power law kind of distribution, which you would get from having the dominant process being small plus large, which you might get if you have some bottleneck at small plus small fusions. And in both cases, most of the buildup will complete within one Hubble time.
So can you explain again the bottleneck a bit? Because you're saying I somehow make small cross section of 1 plus 1.
Or in general, it would be small plus small, but 1 plus 1 was the numerical illustration there.
You don't get rid of the small fast enough, and so then you start building up large objects, but you still have the smaller amount.
So you just add things, so it's easier for one to just get stuck with.
No. So then the cross section is small plus large, is much larger.
Yeah. Exactly. So you don't suppress one plus large. It's still easy for large small ones to accrete onto larger ones, but it's hard for them to combine with smaller ones to produce a larger one in the first place.
So how does it end up being a parallel and populating flat distribution again?
So that basically comes about because...
Robert, yeah. I mean, Mina missed the very first where you did the rough freeze up.
Yeah, okay.
Then we should tell me later, this is taking a lot of time, so...
No, that's fine.
Tell me at the end of the talk, okay?
But the basic picture is that in one scenario, you have everything going up together, you get rid of the small ones, everything just becomes larger and larger.
Yeah.
And the other one, you have a large population building up, at the same time the small one keeps.
Yes.
And just that cross-section is much larger than the large one.
So you'd have some drip feed of larger things being created, and then those quickly accrete smaller things onto them.
I see. So that's why you end up
getting exactly. Okay. So the number density of large things isn't changing very much, but their size is because they're accreting small ones on. That's fine. Okay, so.
So there are three three possible places. Mm-hmm. Either you're just completely dominated by small, nothing happens as a sum bubble.
Sure.
Or just everything becomes very large.
Yep.
Or the smaller.
So those are the regimes if you assume that once you're large enough, you get into this kind of geometrical scaling regime. Of course, it might still be possible, even for large things, they have funny effects based on big shells or whatever that mess you about there. But if you assume that once you get large enough, you get into this kind of geometrical regime, those are the kind of options that you'd have. Okay. So just to give a very brief overview of how this relates to some other models of...
Actually, if you look at just standard model cross-sections for sort of the moderate-sized nuclei, where it starts to be geometric, but Coulomb doesn't dominate.
But what, sorry?
But Coulomb repulsion doesn't dominate yet. So like Coulomb iron, I guess.
Yeah, sure. So that kind of...
Does it roughly scale this way?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Are
there fission cross-sections, like, you know, neutron-induced fission cross-sections comparable? Or are they suppressed?
So for the standard model, the dominant de-excitation process of these things is emitting a one or two neutrons.
Well, of course, there's also photon emissions, which I imagine.
So those four nuclear neutrons are, I think, generally subdominant. Those are for the lower energy gap things. Photon emission is important, but I think for generic. So collisions at reasonably high energies, these things, the dominant de-excitation mechanism is emitting a few neutrons. So in that case, doing the one plus a larger thing is not going to give you the kind of stuff here because you won't be able, your de-excitation won't happen in the right way.
What about large plus large?
So large plus large, you have the...
Oxygen.
Yes.
Ring physics.
In that regime, intermediate regime, before Coulomb becomes important, you do get scaling in this time. You're absolutely right. One of the early questions you asked is, of course, they're also you're causing dissociations as well sometimes.
Yes.
So it's not completely just fusions up.
Right.
But the point is what that has is both things are scaling geometrically. And so, maybe there's a ratio between the two when you get between, you know, fusions, aggregation process and dissociation. But the crucial thing is whether you have, there's more fusion than there is disassociation. That's one thing. In that first part of the curve as you're building up towards iron. And the second thing is they're scaling geometrically.
Yeah.
They're scaling together geometrically.
Right.
And so it expresses the sort of the prefactor number.
Yes.
But that, it turns out the prefactor number doesn't make that much of a, you know.
But so you say it doesn't actually change that. I mean, have you put in kernels like that to see whether it changes the asymptotic form?
No. So yeah, if you just do it numerically and you put in small variations, like you have some kind of ratio of dissociation put in, you do get qualitatively the same kind of behavior. I mean, you, like John said, you will get different prefactors attached to all these things. But yeah, qualitatively, this will be robust to making small changes along those kind of lines. Yeah, I'm not exactly.
Well, it sounds like this is an order one change, but in terms of you're adding brand new processes of comparable size to the.
Okay.
But you're saying even with it's still relatively stable under those. Or
so
those
So you'd need to be a bit careful with the order one change. I'd need to go back and check on that. Okay, so just to talk a bit briefly about how this relates to other kind of models of nuclear composite dark matter that have been considered. So specific strong coupling models, so like people like Detmold and McCulloch have considered. So they took the example of two-flavor QCD. In that particular case, they found that large number states appear to be unbound. So in that kind of model, you wouldn't get any built up beyond the first few. And they get dark matter from mesons, small nuclei. It would be very interesting to look at whether and with what kind of parameters QCD-like models do give large bound states and do have small interaction cross sections such that you could get to those regimes. That is further work should need to be done. Yes, and then let's skip through these bits at the moment. Okay, so now moving on, so that was looking at the synthesis of these kind of objects. So now we'll look a bit at the kind of signatures that you might see if present-day dark matter is in the form of these large, composite, reasonably uniform kind of states. So we've looked at some of the most model-independent, quotes, consequences you might see. So one of those is that the kind of soft scattering that you get, because these things are made up of some large number of constituents, would be enhanced by this factor A squared. So the number density will go down compared to just single nucleons floating about as 1 over A, but that means you'd still get an enhancement of direct detection rates at maximum proportional to A. You'd have to look at the momentum dependence there, but we'll come back to that later. Turning that round, for a given direct detection rate, that means you'd suppress the kind of signals you'd expect from single constituent production or whatever at colliders. Again, come back to examples. So there's also the possibility, because these things would have spatial extent, of seeing momentum-dependent form factors in scatterings. And also the spatial extent means that you might get low-energy collective excitations, which you coherently excite. The fact that you have potential for a spectrum of excited modes could also have consequences for self-interactions between dark matter and indirect detection astrophysical quantum signals. So we'll talk a bit about all of these things. In any specific model, there would be potentially many other possibilities which you want to investigate. Okay, so firstly to look at the form factors and scattering stuff. So if the radius of your dark state is larger than the inverse momentum transfer in some scattering process, then that scattering process will probe the dark form factor. So as a simple example of what kind of thing it might look like, if you just had some sharp boundary, if you had some uniform matter and then a sudden change to outside it, that gives you a spherical Bessel function kind of form factor of the kind that you see roughly in standard model nuclei. So this plot shows the dark curve is the form factor for the nuclear charge distribution of a standard model atom. This one here is the spherical Bessel function thing. So once you get past the first couple of peaks, it's suppressed by the skin depth, by the fact that you're starting to probe the scale of individual constituents, here the protons and neutrons. But that's an example that, yeah, you could reasonably expect to get something that does have fairly pronounced peaks and troughs out of this kind of dark form factor. So putting that together with the coherent enhancement, so the fact that the low momentum transfer cross-sections would have a rate going as A squared, where A would be the dark nucleon number, and N squared, where N would be the standard model nucleon number of whatever nucleus you're scattering against. So this is an example where we have some state which is 50 femtometers large, so quite a bit larger than usual standard model nuclei. That's, you're going to need that because most direct detection experiments don't strongly probe the interesting parts of the standard model nucleus form factor. So in order to see the interesting bits of the dark form factor, it would need to correspond to a state of larger radius. So in this case, we have some, it's like 10 to the 6-ish constituents, each of which have a very small cross-section with nucleons. And that gives you some form factor with interesting energy dependence that's roughly in the same region as WIMPs with about with a much larger cross-section with nucleons.
What is the effective scale? Lambda, I would imagine, is the effective scale of the interaction between the... What are you imagining that it is?
So
M1 is the mass of a single proton, basically, right?
On the dark, yeah.
On the dark side, right? Of the dark nucleon. So it's 20 dev.
Yeah.
But it's fairly large.
Mm-hmm.
R is the size of the... Of
composite
the,
state.
Of the full nucleus.
Sure, so these things... Of the full nucleus, of the full 10 to 3 times 10 to the 6 of these
so
things.
So this goes like the size of the nucleon is 1 over 20,
J? Roughly, a bit, little bit bigger than that. So you're assuming it's something like a proton, but scaled up.
Okay. Yeah. And so, the lambda is what? What are you getting to get the dimension 6? What is the effective scale? Is this something detectable?
Well, so that's you could translate this cross-section back into the kind of scales that you'd need. So this is the usual WIMP kind of thing. Scale that down by a factor of about 4. Or so scale lambda up by some associated factor.
4, so it's roughly a factor of 10.
Yeah, about that.
But the point is lambda can be larger in this case.
Yeah,
and in the normal standard model, normal WIMP case.
Which the effective scale makes
more sense. Sure. So, for example, if you had the coupling via Higgs portal or something, then the kind of bounds you'd get from Higgs invisible width or whatever would be less strong for a given direct detection rate in this model than they would be in standard WIMP scattering.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
So this QGD phase transition happens before hours.
For
example, at the cosmology of this thing?
So in detailed model, so that's that is something we still need to do.
So
it would be very nice to look at specific models where you could actually go through in a conservative system way and
to see what we
try to make the whole cosmology work out. That's still something we need to do. Any was the question there?
Yeah. Bob was just asking about
Is single is that it's permanently on, right?
This is the cross section with a single nucleon.
Okay, and then up to the coherent, up to the form factor suppression, there would naively be a soft scattering A squared and S squared.
Yes.
So it'd be like a barn.
Well, picobar, right?
Yeah.
It's 10^-13 picobar.
Yeah.
So. Okay, good.
Still, but you're saying, so it's actually much less, I guess, because of the finite size effect.
Yes, exactly. So here, you're getting. Because this is quite a lot bigger than standard model nucleus, you are getting a fairly large momentum suppression there. So that's true in this case. Okay, so, before we talked about the kind of size distribution you might expect in synthesis processes, now that would, of course, mean that you have dark matter of different sizes hitting your detector, each of these would have a different radius, and averaging all these things out, you would get some effective form factor that looked like some kind of weighted average of these things. So this was our kind of scaling distribution from previously, so if we take, say, that point on it, that would correspond to a form factor that looks like this because it's a large state and is probed by fairly small momenta. A smaller one needs large momenta to probe it, so it would look like this kind of form factor. When you average them all out, what you actually get is something that's reasonably nice and smoothly falling. So this would be and looks roughly like the kind of thing you might get from intermediate mass mediators. That's what this dotted curve is. So this is a less striking kind of signature. You don't have the sort of big peaks and troughs. You could still, as lots of other people have investigated, see momentum-dependent scattering of this kind and distinguish it from WIMP stuff if you had multiple detectors and a reasonable number of events in each thing. This kind of thing would be more difficult to distinguish from other kinds of models of momentum-dependent scattering. To take the very most optimistic case, so going back on what we said earlier, let's just assume that these things are a single size, whatever reason. Then the fact you have got these peaks and troughs means that you could see something reasonably striking. So the event rate in direct detection, usually, so you have your mean inverse speed velocity integral thing, which is increasing, which is decreasing as Vmin goes up, and Vmin is increasing in your recoil energy. So if we ignore the momentum-dependent form factors, then your recoil energy spectrum can't increase as you make your energy recoil energy go up. Turning that round, if you do see any increase in it, then that's a robust sign, independent of assumptions about the dark matter, velocity distribution, whatever, that you're seeing something different from point-like elastic scattering. So putting in some rough kind of numbers in this scenario, so let's say you had, so this is your form factor with some peaks and troughs which are in your range of your direct detection experiments, then, and these are some sampled events from it. In red, we've indicated the part of it that really doesn't look, according to statistical tests, like it's from a falling distribution. Then, with a reasonably small number of events in this kind of scenario, you could actually get a pretty robust exclusion of point-like elastic scattering. So here, this is just pulling out the CDFs, 2 sigma, 3 sigma with 50 events, you could reasonably expect 2 sigma, 100 events, 3 sigma exclusion there. Of course, in a realistic experiment, you'd need to think about backgrounds, all kinds of complications. These are just rough numbers to indicate that, yeah, in this kind of scenario, you could see something interesting with relatively few events. Okay. So, yeah, sure.
So depending on how large your nucleus is, you have to worry about, as you plow through normal matter,
yeah. It
would just more likely actually kick out, you interact with one of your so-called neutrons, kick
yes.
them out, and it would be an inelastic process rather than elastic.
Yes. So, well, that depends on the binding energy of these things.
But is there sufficiently large, the binding energy is very low.
Well, no. So the binding energy doesn't get lower as you make these things large.
No.
The energy of the low energy excitations
right. Gets
lower. So yes, so we have thought about, it turns out that actually not kicking out single constituents, but collective excitations, so as in the longer wavelength modes of these kind of objects, will be the dominant process by which you might have inelastic scattering. And yes, those will generally be subdominant to the elastic scattering case for kind of reasonable parameters, but you could get some non-negligible fraction of your events exciting those kind of modes in the kind of particular models we considered. In some other model, I imagine there are models where once you get large enough, the dominant thing is kicking off individual constituents. For fermionic, degenerate fermionic matter, that's actually, that's quite suppressed. But yeah, inelastic is interesting.
In our upcoming paper, we're explicitly considering these long wavelength collective excitations versus single particle excitations. The advantage of the long wavelength collective excitations, as Robert discovered, is they are partially coherently enhanced. Right? When the single particle, single particle knocking out a single nucleon
yep.
of the dark sector, you're suffering from the fact that the raw standard model dark sector interaction cross section is very tiny.
Yeah.
Right?
And you don't have the A squared factor that you do on the collective side.
But you do have significant, he's going to talk about this. Significant, you have the possibility of interesting inelasticity. But it comes to the long wavelength collective method.
In the kind of models we've been considering.
Okay.
And what do you say the kind of models are, which class of the three cases you were discussing, the formation case, or is it just independent?
No, so this is we assume we've got some population of these things floating around produced by something in the early universe.
Okay.
But
you
this
didn't
is,
take any specific population that matches whatever you said to
me. Well, so that was this plot.
So that was this plot, yes. So
yeah.
When you talk about an elastic stuff, does it depend the statements that you just made?
Well, so that depends on the assumption that these states are made out of roughly uniform matter. So you've got things like surface waves and compressional waves.
But it doesn't, if you had the same curve like that, then you'd still produce the same signature. You still have
inelastic scattering. Of course, you'd get it over some distribution of sizes.
Yeah,
so the effective form factor for it would also be averaged out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm asking. So does it, so how significant it is after you take such things into account?
Well, it'll be averaged out in the same way that the elastic one will be. So you'll remove interesting momentum-dependent features as well in that case, as well as initially being subdominant.
Will it look significantly different than the elastic case, or even if you average it out, you'll talk a lot?
I will. Okay, I will go back to this at the end. All right. So that's direct detection phenomenology. Saying a little bit about kind of astrophysical consequences. You've got the usual constraints on getting rid of abundances of other hidden sector states. So we've got some kind of binding force. We've potentially got lighter states that we might want to de-excite into. So all of those, we would generically want to get rid of any large abundances before BBN. To be safe, you can model build around after that. New features in this case are that you got release of binding agent from fusions of these things, and also some spectrum inelastic modes, which might be interesting at later times as well. So most of the binding energy from fusions is released during the nuclear synthesis process, if it actually builds up to some reasonable stage. And again, safest before BBN. Post freeze out of these fusions, the rate, if we're in the geometrical limit, will scale, velocity suppressed. So the strongest constraints will be from present day indirect detection observations, as opposed to early universe CMB stuff or whatever. So yes, in specific models, you could maybe see the potential for interesting indirect detection phenomenology in these things. Putting in some rough astrophysical numbers. So these things are reasonably strongly self-interacting. So do we need to worry about self-interaction constraints, like in halos? And the general point here is that because we're assuming that cross-sections saturate at the geometrical value, if we start out at roughly standard model levels, so the elastic scattering limit is about 1 bar per GeV before halo constraints start to get dangerous. So if you start out not too far away from there, then your A factor will suppress you even further, and that shouldn't really be a worry. Roughly estimating the kind of energy injection you might get from fusions. So if we just plug in the kind of fraction of the mass density that you might get out, you get something which goes like a to the minus 2/3 here. For a very rough comparison, if you took some annihilating symmetric dark matter, whatever, then you get out some fraction at energies which, in these kind of parameters, might be comparable to the energy you're injecting of order the same order of magnitude. Of course, in any actual model, the detectability of signals would depend on what you're injecting to, how that decays, all kinds of things, but just as rough numbers, there might be something interesting to say here. Again, this would come into play once you actually had some model which you were dealing with, and that is work in progress. There's all the potential for inelastic interactions between these states to have interesting effects, potentially indirect detection stuff, and also maybe on dark matter distributions themselves. So this would only be important in regions of very high dark matter density, like in galactic cores or between captured dark matter within stars or something like that. So there, you've got, well, either the possibility of exothermic kind of collisions that you might get from fusions where you release some energy. There you have possibility of things getting velocity kicks, as in they recoil against stuff, the excitation products that they send out. And these kind of things can clear out higher density regions. You also have the possibility of collisions being dissipative. You're losing some kinetic energy from the dark matter distribution, and that can lead it to contract. Putting in rough numbers, rough estimates that we've done, it looks like, for example, in the case of things within stars, this kind of process could lead to a runaway situation where all of the stuff within your star contracts down to a very dense configuration in the center. Of course, to actually investigate this properly, you'd need to simulate this kind of the orbits and all these things in rather more detail than we've done. But it looks like there's a potential for interesting effects on that kind of front. Okay, so that's pretty much the material that I have to say on this.
Are you guys doing work on this? Is there a way to make it more concrete? The last
yes.
Part
of the universe? Yeah, the concrete models are very much the next thing.
Okay.
So just to go through briefly. So the idea of nuclear dark matter, as it's being called, having dark matter which is made up of large composite bound states, interesting one. And the kind of the work that we've been doing is looking at the the possibilities of these things get into some regime where they obey simple scaling laws and look like roughly uniform matter. On the synthesis side, this means that you have a possibility of reasonably generic kinds of number distributions that you might get out from early universe synthesis, potentially with very large number states. And there's also potential consequences of these kind of large composite states for direct detection and potentially astrophysical phenomenology. And certainly, it would be extremely interesting to see if concrete motivated models can realize this, which is hopefully the next step. We'll see whether they actually work. But yeah, so thanks very much. Well, is that a no comment or what?
Yes, it looks like twin Higgs models give you some version of this phenomenon. It's the second set, it's the B sector physics. In particular, we started looking at the fraternal twin Higgs, which has a nice version, of this. And, well, we'll see in the next, it's work progress.
No, I mean, so it's certainly not guaranteed that it would, that the phenomenon will actually work out in one of these regimes, but
on first pass, yes, this is one version. And this would give you very specific things, because it's interacting with other Higgs portal, obviously, it's all the interactions with other Higgs portal.
Sure.
And
I thought we needed to get rid of the first two families in the lightest.
That's why it's fraternal fit.
Oh, it's another version of the twin Higgs, sorry.
No.
So the lightest state is not the gluon.
No. Sorry, there's two
stable
states.
Yeah.
Right? The gluon is not stable, right?
I see.
The gluon decays back to us, right? Well, exactly. It's a 0++ gluon that mixes with the Higgs.
Okay.
The point
so
is that there's a nucleon state which is stable enough to be the dipole.
And you can produce it without messing everything up and getting the right solution for the electrolyte.
That's what we're checking.
Okay.
That's what we're checking. Right. That's why I don't know whether this works yet. So I don't want to say that. But
it's just like twin Higgs so much.
It has a bunch of features that seem to work well.
Yeah, okay.
Right. But this is work in progress.
Okay.
So wait a few weeks and I'll have a more definite statement.
Okay.
So just to,
finish your cup.
Oh no, so I was just going to, on the inelastic side, sorry, I should have had this as a backup, but let me just get that one here. So this is a plot of the kind of form factors that you would get with exciting surface modes. So this one is the elastic scattering form factor. The red dotted one, which is out of phase with it, is the form factor for exciting the first few surface modes in a particular regime. So you again get the Hering enhancement. You get some further form factor, which is different, but still is momentum suppressed and suppressed by some other factors.
Why are surface modes and not bulk modes? Can you have breathing modes?
So the reason why the surface modes, we take the surface modes here, is that those are generically lower energy than the bulk modes.
I see.
So the energy, the collisions here are low energy, and you generally require more energy to excite the bulk modes. If you're able to, those will often be less suppressed, but you need the energy to do that.
I was going to ask, in your Boltzmann system, you get this universal scaling because, for your purposes, it doesn't matter whether or not lighter states are emitted for energy conservation. But generically, if you have an asymmetric system or an asymmetric scenario, you're going to have to at least deplete the symmetric component, right?
Yes.
So I would expect in a lot of those cases that would significantly change how you model your binding energies, right?
So in what sense?
Because if you have a strong enough interaction, right? So like suppose like an invisible sector, you don't annihilate the photon for the same electromagnetic force, that induces a Coulomb term in how nuclei talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
The binding energy. and that will affect where things turn around.
So whether you can de-excite fast enough
You can have models. In fact, I've built models in the past with like my collaborators like Lawrence Hall and Matthew McCullough, where you can do the annihilation of the. This is the issue about getting rid of the symmetric component of the dark matter. So it's the nucleons annihilating with the antinucleons, and you can do that fast enough just by having light pseudoscalar or light scalar states in your system. You don't need a photon-like state. You don't need a Coulomb-like force. It's a crucial thing. You already know. So you do it in light quantums, or you can do it in light Hubble states. Either is possible. Right? And you get it fast enough. So there will be a tiny population of symmetric stuff left around, of course. But
sure,
very
like
tiny.
But exponentially suppressed.
Yeah, exponentially suppressed, yeah.
So the important thing is that these are more like heavy quark, heavy baryons, rather than. Right, because then you have your light
balls
here.
Genetically, you only want some light states hanging around.
You would not expect this to work if you're dealing with light quark.
Absolutely. Which is one of the reasons why the twin fraternal footprint works.
Okay.
Yes. Forgive me if I missed this. What are the limits on the cross sections for the inelastic cross sections? Can you make them as high as you want it, or what would be?
Well, so you're going to get some, for a given model, you will get some limits on the coupling between your dark set of constituents and your standard model states.
Right.
And then, exciting the inelastic modes, the cross section for exciting the elastic modes and the cross section for the exciting the inelastic modes will be functions of that coupling.
Sure.
So you put some limits on that coupling.
But if you mess with the dark sector, it seems like you could make those, the coupling of the dark nucleon very light, very easily get excited. Is that not?
The kind of regimes that we looked at, so like Peter was saying, like I was saying rather. I was saying too.
Taking credit for other people's work is the way we do it.
So in the regimes that we were looking at, generally the elastic cross section was dominating, and you might have some subdominant contribution for collective inelastic modes. If you have very big states, then the dominant effect may well be excitation of individual inelastic things and individual constituents. Those are not the kind of regime that we looked at, and in particular, you'd need to go quite away in the kind of situation we were to get there. You would no longer actually have the collider constraint suppressed in that kind of scenario.
All right, so any more questions? If not, I should also remind you that we have dinner tonight with Robert.
Huh?
And are you going to join?
Yes.
Well, then we'll have two Englishmen for dinner.
That sounds sinister.
That will be a merry event. All right, so let's thank Robert once again.